Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
Hi, this is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. I'm Bruce Daisley. It's a podcast about making work better. Had loads of people getting in touch with me after last week's Rutger Bregman episode. I think partly because he's just such an inspiring, different thinker. And if you are interested in his work, I don't think I could have done a more complete job of talking up his books last week, but I've put a transcript of the conversation that I had with him on the website. If you are interested in that, you'll find it at eatsleepworkrepeat.com. Or you could, while you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter, which arrives in over 10,000 email inboxes every Tuesday evening. Never quite know when to send it. But if you do want to sign up for that, it's a big collection of people who are interested in workplace culture and improving their work. Lovely conversation for today's episode. I'm talking to Elizabeth Uvibenene, and Elizabeth is a columnist for the Financial Times, but she's just one of those people who is really helping to shape an evolving culture when it comes to how voices are heard. So Elizabeth, alongside Yomi Adikoki, wrote Slay in Your Lane, The Black Girl's Bible. Huge seller. I think, you know, as we're going to discuss today, the publishing industry is often incredibly conservative. So firstly, to get a book like that published is just an incredible accomplishment. But then to sell it in the numbers it has is a real tribute to Elizabeth and Yomi's real vision of what was going to happen. So today, Elizabeth is going to be talking about her new book, which is, I think, a fresh perspective on the way that we should be rethinking work, society, the way we operate. You know, we're all coming out of pandemic. We're all coming out of this moment where we've been forced to reflect on doing things differently. And Elizabeth's new book, The Reset, Ideas to Change How We Work and Live, is a very readable, tangy take on that. So to give you an outline, Elizabeth is an FT writer. One of the things that she's observed along the way is that she wrote an article about burnout on the Financial Times a couple of years ago, and it was one of the most read articles of the month. She's had experience of working in big corporates and also being this, you know, groundbreaking writer. We're going to talk about various things. An interesting perspective on purpose, just the appetite for change that there is out there, and, you know, what it was like to write a book as iconic and successful as Slay in Your Lane. So it's a great discussion. I loved it, actually. It's a really fresh perspective on some of the issues that we're all affected by. And we talk later on about these people who are remarkably, prodigiously successful. But Elizabeth, this is her third book and she's 28. So shout out to her. So here's the author of The Reset, Elizabeth Uvibenene. Liz, thank you so much for chatting to me here. I'm so thrilled to talk to you.
No, thanks for having me, Bruce. I'm really looking forward to this.
Well, it must be exciting, actually. You've written a book about, I think, capturing a degree of the spirit of change as We're all infused, impossibly and against all of our better judgment, with this sort of pervasive optimism right now. So you've written a really timely book, and were you sort of sitting on these ideas for a long time, and this just felt like the moment to get them out? Tell me what inspired you to write The Reset.
Yeah, no, so I've always been kind of like fascinated about the way we work, how we work, why. And that's what led me to like my first book, Slaying Your Lane. So when that book came out, I still had questions that went beyond what it is to be a young Black woman in the workplace and just generally. So I have a column at the FT where I write about work generally. And I just, you know, was just quite curious. And I had the idea of The Reset before the pandemic. And back then it was going to be called Out of Office When Work Isn't Working. And that was because I just didn't feel as if there were millions of people that were going into work and loads of people that were leaving because they just didn't feel satisfied around the way they were working. And I saw that a lot with like young Black women like myself, but I saw that with you know, white men and, you know, people with living with disabilities and, you know, mothers. And there was just a real kind of like inflexibility about the workplace and how people wanted to work. And there was a real tension there that I just didn't understand. And I think for me, I was like, okay, I really want to write about this. And so I started speaking to a publisher about this, and the pandemic hit, and it just took on its life of its own, to be honest. And yeah, The Reset.
Fab, fantastic. I just want to take it one step back. So you mentioned Slaying Your Lane there. So obviously you wrote this book with Yomi, and it was all about, as you said there, sort of Black woman's perspective of modern life.
Yeah. So the challenges that I guess, you know, Black women face and you know, living and growing up in Britain and essentially how we navigate things such as work, but also areas such as, you know, the health industry in the UK, healthcare and access to that, some of the challenges, the education system. So it was a real, so it's called Slaying Your Lane, the Black Girl Bible. So it's a real kind of like 120,000 words or just a real in-depth analysis of these things told through our voices, me and Yomi, but also 40 brilliant, successful Black British women. But the genesis of the book started around the fact that I wanted a book that spoke to my experiences of what it is to be a Black woman in the workplace. And it just folded out into so many different areas.
Tell me the story of that, because that book to me seems like it's been a real phenomenon. It feels, you know, it feels just like it caught a moment. And I know the publishing industry a little bit. And so I'm really astonished that they said that there was a market in, you know, you've effectively chosen a really specific cohort and spoke so helpfully and directly to that group that that group has felt, you know, inspired, it's created a movement, it's created a sense of pride and identity in that group. But I just know the publishing sector, was it hard to get that book published?
Do you know what? This is such a good question, because we came up with the idea March 2015. So it's a while ago now. And this was before the kind of, you know, diversity boom with Black Panther, with, you know, Beyonce dropping Lemonade and like her album. And there was just a real kind of synergy.
I like the fact you're putting your book with Lemonade. Come on.
Of course I had to do that. And Black Panther. It was a very, you know, a cultural renaissance in terms of even Black British identity in the UK, people like Stormzy. And there's a real kind of like, this was before that. So this was 2015. And this stuff was like 3 years later. So to answer your question, was it hard? I think it was, we felt like very much outsiders looking into this industry, and we didn't know where to begin. And we do what everybody does, you know, you have an idea and you have questions and you just go to Google. So at first, so we didn't know anybody, we didn't have any contacts, and we were very much naive. I was like, you know, 22. So we were very much outside looking in and wanted to write this book. We didn't want to go down the self-published route, and we wanted to walk into a Waterstones, a W.H. Smith's and a Foyles and see our book with every other book and not sidelined to, you know, you have to self-publish because nobody else is going to publish your book. Or so was it difficult? I think the hardest part was pulling together and proving that there was a market in our proposal. That was the biggest thing, because before this, before Slaying Your Lane, there wasn't books geared towards Black women. Now, like, there are so many. And
in
that's
fiction,
amazing.
In nonfiction, it's like, you know, it seems like it's a really active and a high purchasing segment of the market.
I love the fact that you said high purchasing, because that's a key thing in nonfiction books. Like, how can you prove a market? How do you prove that Black women want to read about other Black women doing well? Of course, we know because we read about white women doing well. Yeah. So why wouldn't we want to read about ourselves? So I think that we knew in our spirit and we were very passionate. We knew this was something that was going to do well, but it was kind of like, how do you translate that into data, into a real kind of thing that you're speaking the publisher's language, i.e. is it going to make money? So I think before then, was it hard? I think that was probably the most challenging part, you know, going on the Office of National Statistics and pulling together like things and how many Black women are in the UK versus how many this. And so we were very much like into the detail, and like it paid off like tremendously afterwards, because we kind of like, you know, crossed all our T's and dotted all our I's. And yeah,
fantastic. So I'm just incredibly impressed. What was your motivating factor? I chatted to Yomi, and Yomi said that her experience, it wasn't a podcast, it was just to chat me and her, and she said her experience was that she was seeing so many Black women of her age go into careers and, you know, having performed at elite level at university and got a great degree, and then go into careers, and there was sort of so much latent aggression in the office that she found it was very difficult in it. And, you know, she had a good job, and she found it very difficult to hold that down against the spirit. I'm putting words probably going further than I could directly quote it, but she felt that there was an undercurrent of latent aggression to young Black women. Mm. Was that one of the motivations of writing the book? Have I even sort of misremembered that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think for me it was two things. One being the fact that I was I looked at my boss, he was white, his boss was white, his boss was white, his boss was white. And there's a real kind of like, if I'm a very strategic person, and, you know, I wouldn't say I'm the smartest, you know, cookie in the box, but like in school, I had like average grades apart from English. So I've always been very much like just getting on with things in life. But I looked at the workplace and I thought, if I'm going to really try and get ahead here, I'm going to have to, you know, change who I am and mold myself into something else, because the version of what I'm presented as, like in terms of what leadership looks like, doesn't look like me. So I can't hide the fact that, you know, I'm Black. I can't hide the fact that I'm a woman. So how am I going to kind of succeed in this structure? I was working for a big bank, and I was like, you know, I was made to feel certain aspects that I could succeed, but I would have to change. And that was done through things such as microaggressions and people speaking over you and just little things that make you think that you have to work twice as hard to be heard, to be seen. But you're already quite visible. So because you're, you know, you don't look like everybody else. So I really had to ask myself, like, could I do it? Could I strategically, you know, get up the ladder and really try to kind of, you know, mold myself and be this version of myself that I knew I had what it took, you know, to do that. But I asked myself the second question, is it desirable? Is it something I want to do for myself? And I think it was the second question for me that changed things. It was like, I could do this, but it's not desirable. I would be giving up a lot of, like, you know, who I am. And like, I didn't want to compromise on that. And I knew that other Black women felt similarly. So that was where it kind of came from, that sense of like, there must be another way to do things. And I'm a very curious person. I was a curious child. I always used to ask, I would annoyingly ask my parents and people around me, like, why this, why that? Like, so I, that spirit of curiosity just made me think to myself, there must be another way. So that's what led me to read books such as Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg. And then, you know, that fateful conversation I had with Yomi, where I said to her, you're a writer, you're a journalist, like, I need to write. I need you to do this very small favor for me. This very small favor, and write this book for me. And she, you know, as best friends do, you can do it too, girl. And then we ended up partnering up. But it was definitely not something I saw in myself. I definitely saw it in her, and she saw it in me. And
And just quickly, because we're going to talk about the reset now. So how did you? So you did this anthology that came out sort of last year, which was the Loud Black Girls, which was, I guess, sort of continuing the spirit of that and putting other people on. How did you choose the women to write in that?
So we had met so many amazing women along the journey after publishing Staying Your Lane in 2018. And how do we choose them? It was so random. So with Staying Your Lane, it was very much, we want to, you know, we're looking very much at the past and women who of a previous generation to us. With this, with Loud Black Girls, we just want to take on a new different type of energy. So it was very random how we came to kind of pick the women. It was people that we kind of met along the way, along our journey. There's a girl called Sophia Thakur. She's a poet and she's so incredibly talented. And I remember I went to an award show and she was there performing with Stylist, Stylist Remarkable Women's Award. And she was performing on the stage and I just got goosebumps and like her words, like I'm not really a big poetry fan, like and spoken words, but she just spoke to me in a different level. So I remember texting Yomi and saying, she's got to be in this book, like right. The way with words. So it was very random in that way. And everybody's there because they have something to say, something unique to say, something vibrant, something that's going to add to the conversation. And every essay that we have in this anthology is so unique. And it's just so future looking. And that's why I think it's really resonated with people.
Poetry's a funny one, isn't it? It's like, I think a lot of us would say we're not necessarily poetry fans, but sometimes poetry can really hit you in your emotions. It can really sort of
unexpectedly,
like, yeah, and when it does that, it sort of knocks you off your feet. So absolutely, yeah. You know, and when a poet gets it right, like the talented woman from the presidential inauguration, when a poet gets it right, it sort of stays with you for days and days and days. It's got this sort of enduring quality to it. Tell me this, so you've basically sort of taken on, you know, you thought with the reset, you're thinking about how we can do things different, actually sort of just questioning some of the ways that we do things. It wasn't your piece, was it, on the Financial Times saying that millennials and Gen Zs think that work is crazy? I was gonna say that that's a good concept. I'm not sure if that was your piece or not, but that's sort of the spirit of what you're saying.
Absolutely. And it's so funny because every time I've got a column at the FT, so every time I write in the FT, I try to inject like the fact that, you know, I am millennial and there's a different perspective here, and the comments just go crazy because it's like, you're not that special. You're no different to us. Like, so it's so funny. So sometimes I know that if I drop millennial, that it's going to get people going, and I don't know if it's right or wrong, but.
And it's quite good for that then. Use it as a trigger word.
It does. It just, people just are like, you're just such a slow flake. But I think it's good to kind of talk about the commonalities, but the differences, especially when it comes to work. I write about the fact that, you know, there is a real kind of energy when it comes to millennials and Gen Z about how much we are vocal about our treatment in the workplace and how we want to do things differently. It's not saying that we're revolutionaries and, you know, we're the first to ever have done anything. But I think there's a real sense of like, you know what, why we're asking more questions and we're asking more of the businesses that we work for more than, you know, I guess previous generations have. And I think that that's what's quite different about what we are, like the conversations that we're creating. It's not saying we're the first to ever say it, but I think we're saying it in larger volumes. And, you know, we're using terms such as burnout in popular culture in a way that it can only be a good thing, because we're talking about mental health in a way that is at the forefront of why we want to work in a particular way. And I think that sometimes at work, we can feel powerless and we can go to this whole parent-child relationship that I want to kind of get away from, where in every area of life, we are comfortable talking about what we want for ourselves and advocate. But for some reason, when it comes to the world of work, we wait for our managers to kind of, you know, tell, like, there's a real kind of disempowerment that I don't feel that our generation want to go along with, and we want to speak out and we want to, you know, really break out away from that. And I think that's why I like to highlight about there is a difference, and it's not saying we're the best and we're this, but we do think about things differently.
What's your take on the whole idea? Because so much of work right now is packaged up as sort of part of our identity, and one of the ways that effectively work tries to do that is by talking about purpose and trying to suggest that the job that firms are doing has got this sort of greater societal need to it. And you talk a little bit about purpose, but I'm interested in how you reflect on the way that firms use purpose and invite individuals to have purpose.
That's such a good question, and that's something that I think is a conversation. more than anything. Like, I think, and it's so specific to each individual. I don't really buy into the whole, you know, you have to like have, you have to see work as part of your identity. And, you know, if you're not saving the world and if your work isn't attached to a broader mission, then you are not successful and all of those things. Well, you know, I don't really buy into that. But I also, I think it's a very individual approach. And I think for so long, it can feel like if your work isn't basically, you know, sticking up to the people, whatever it is, and you're not, you may feel like you have to be an activist at work. There must be something that you're taking away from it. And it can be the opposite. You just literally, I've met people who they do their work and then they want what they do at work to be left at work and have two separate identities and things like that. And I personally, for me, I know that when I worked at the bank where I worked 3 years ago, I know that I was happy with the work I was doing, but it didn't fulfill me in a way that the work I do now like does. But I guess that's because, you know, I can come up with an idea and write a book about it. So I'm not saying that's, you know, for everybody, but I am saying that what I especially like about like how I work now is I can bring more parts of myself to the work. And I think that makes it richer. And I think that's what I enjoy about it. I am not, you know, covering who I am and parts of my identity in order to fit an idea of what a leader should be and what, you know, what things should be. I can be a bit, you know, like, I wouldn't say I can be a bit different. I can be a bit individual and bring the fact that I did grow up in South London. I am, you know, 28 and, you know, I have a different perspective and I can bring that to the work I do. But I think before, 3 years ago, I didn't feel comfortable doing that because all I saw was I had to be something else and I'm never going to be that thing. So that was always a tension for me. But that's just me. And I think when you talk about purpose in businesses and how, you know, businesses can, I think some businesses use it as a way to, I think the way talent, I think as a business right now, if you don't have a deeper reason to operate other than profit, you're going to lose out on talent sooner rather than later, because I think that the people who are going to go a bit extra mile and all of those things are going to be people who kind of see that purpose in the bigger mission of the company that they work for. That's just my belief. And that rightly or wrongly, like that's just how I feel like businesses these days, if you're not tackling a big problem and if you're not contributing, all you do is just take, then I think that's going to, you know, I don't think that's going to be sustainable for many people.
Do you think it gets misappropriated though? I'm really struck with the, I was looking into something about the VW Dieselgate affair and I've spent so long looking at this and one of the interpretations of the VW Dieselgate affair is that, so you know, this is where they had to, their engines were failing the emission standard in California. And so they needed to make their car engines cleaner. And the boss was very famous as a shouter and he threatened to fire them all. But there was a really interesting thing where, you know, they told themselves, actually one of the reasons, the engineers working on this, they told themselves that actually they were doing good because their car was, despite the fact it was failing the certain emission standards, it was producing less greenhouse gases. So it was a more efficient engine in other ways. It was just quite bad on these specific emissions. So they told themselves, the people who were working on it, you know, okay, we're bad, but we're good in our own way, which is a completely deceptive version of reality. And sometimes that, for me, is an indication of how firms use purpose, that they pretend that they've got this elegant role of trying to improve sanitation in the third world. And they tell everyone about it. And, you know, our job is about helping people. They're not doing that. They're spending, they're greenwashing. In fact, you've probably seen this thing. Yeah. An organization of lawyers who set about trying to prevent brands from greenwashing themselves. So when BP come out and say, we're investing in the renewable future, they want it to be the law that BP have to say, we spend less than 0.1% of our money on renewables. You can't just misdirect people. And that's sometimes what I find with corporate purpose. It's a little bit like that. It's sort of the big marketing campaign that sits at the edge of the toxic waste dump. Is that fair? I mean, I do get your point about B Corps and about businesses needing meeting, but I just wonder if there's something in the fact that it's used inappropriately at times.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, I'm an author, but I also work as a brand strategist with, you know, with businesses. And that's part of the job that I also have to kind of contend with, like, as well. So I definitely agree with you. And I think that consumers are becoming way more savvier in highlighting these things and making sure that, like, you know, brands and businesses aren't just, like you said, greenwashing, and they are missing. And I think there's a tension, because we do want them to play more of a bigger role, because we're seeing the fact that, like, brands and businesses have more power than some governments. Like, so we can't just sit back and just say, all we want from you is just pure profit. So we're holding them into a different, like, accountability. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. I do think that businesses misuse it, but that's because we're asking more of them. And I think I feel like Gen Z and millennials are asking for them to, like, as the stats show, like, you know, I think 94% of consumers, you know, believe that brands we love should have a stronger purpose. So there is that want. I think how it's done, and I think that's the thing about authenticity and transparency, it's more so about how things are done. And some brands and some businesses overstretch themselves because all they want to do is just sell that t-shirt. And they're not really, it's not something that, you know, it's something that has to permeate all through the build, all through their business, not just, you know, in the marketing.
Do you think the sort of coronavirus is going to force us to have a realignment of the way we think about our families, about community, about friends, about our full relationship with the sort of the cities we live in and the world we operate in?
Absolutely. I think so. I think that I've never spent so much time in Croydon. I've never spent so much time in my local community and seeing, you know, the same people every single day. And there's a real kind of, like, community feel, and that I just don't feel like I want to ever get rid of. Like, I want to build upon. It would be such a shame if there are some gains that we've made during this time, and, you know, richer relationships with some family members and friends. And I feel like it's individual to each one of us, but I do think that there is a real sense of, like, yes, I'm happy that, you know, things are going back to normal and, like, we're out of the pandemic and things like that. But I think there was something really special about how we all came together, and there was a real belonging. There's a real kind of, like, connection. And I think that says a lot, because London can be such a lonely place for many people. There are so many people here, but I talk about it in a book, saying that, you know, there's a real sense of loneliness, and you can see loneliness, the stats around loneliness kind of laced in things such as, you know, depression and anxiety and, you know, mental health problems and things like that. And I feel like that's been one of the things that I've kind of experienced spending so much time in Croydon and being part of something, and seeing these people every single day and people looking out for each other. You just don't always get that pre-pandemic. I have to be so honest with you. It just feels as if everybody was very much out for themselves, and it was very individual, and we just went about our days. And I think there was something really nice about slowing down. And I feel like it'd be such a shame if we kind of lost that. So I think it's going to change. I spoke to Sadiq Khan as part of the book, and obviously he has a vested interest in making sure that London is still vibrant and people are still coming in the centre of London. And he was talking about, you know, the high streets for all, how it's not people changing why people coming into London. So it's not just about offices and for work, but it's about play, and how can we play and leisure, and how can we kind of change that so it suits more people and it isn't just, you know, and that kind of adds to the whole, you know, green recovery that people talk about. So I think that there are loads of conversations that are happening, and I think I find it super exciting, because, like I say, we're never going to get this point again. It feels like a special time in history, and there are so many gains to be made, and how things are done and how things could be done. And yeah, I'm super optimistic about that.
Go on then. So Sadiq Khan, I was going to ask you about. So if you were going to give Sadiq Khan two pointers about what you think the Mayor of London has spectacularly almost no powers, but, you know, if you were advising the Prime Minister and you were going to give the Prime Minister a couple of pointers, let's look into that. So what do you think we need to be doing?
That's a big question, Bruce. That's a big question. I'm like...
It's just an interesting point, isn't it? And we could just reflect on it now. It's like, you know, okay, we've seen that actually people are able to see the good in each other a bit more. And there's like weird things like, you know, you'll know well, Croydon or North London or wherever you live, that people have started chatting to their neighbours more than they did. These neighbour WhatsApp groups, these sort of, there's evident.
I have a WhatsApp. Do you? I had a building WhatsApp group. Cannot believe it. Man. I had to leave though, because the notifications were just a bit mad. It was a bit too much.
If you leave, are they seeing you as the snooty woman who lives at number 22?
Of course they are. Of course, and you know what it is? It's because, but do you know what's happened? There was a big building one. So, but then we've created like niche ones. It's people who are interested in different things.
Every group always splits up into the subgroups, man.
Exactly. So in a WhatsApp group full of like almost 200 people, it just, the notification was a bit crazy. So what happened was people were just talking about everything within, you know, 24/7, and all the boilers gone, like is your heating working today? So it just got a bit like generic. And so what we found was people that were really interested in like the people interested in bird watching. So there's a bird watching group that broke away. There were people that were interested in like in cooking and recipes, and so I'm in that group. And so there's just different groups, and like, I found that so special. And we're all in the same building, and now we see each other, and it's just so wonderful.
There's something so fascinating in that, isn't there? Sort of in-group identity, and actually sort of when you can find, often the challenge for us is that we've got so many, I think this one guy calls it the variable self. You know, we've got so many different ways that we can present ourselves. But when one of your variable selves meets someone else who's got the same interest in you as you, it is so powerful, that connection. And it's an interesting point that you make, because to some extent, because we've been deprived that non-work connection in the last 12 months, we've seen humanity in other places in our cities. And it's probably a healthy thing, you know, to the discussion we've just had on purpose at work. I do wonder if one of the things that we've been able to witness this year is that we've all been in a cult. We've all been, you know, the people who do a job, we've all been in a cult. And it's been like, I've got to get to work for this time. If I don't get to work at this time, the cult leader will be very unhappy. If I don't this, the cult leader will be. And, you know, we've all been, we've been hypnotized into thinking this is the only way to live. And it's why there's this extraordinary thing, which now we've been had the scales knocked from our eyes and seen that there is a different way to live. When the cult leaders in some organizations are saying, we want you all back in the office, there's a degree, like, you know, you sort of captured the sense of it. But there's some people saying, I don't think it needs to be like that. And it's such an interesting, potentially revolutionary moment for people to be reflecting on those things.
Absolutely. And what you said about the cult leadership, that's so true. I call it like the parent-child relationship, because it's like that thing when you're younger and your mum is like, you've got to be home at this time, and you know, you're running behind. And my heart used to beat when my dad used to say that. And I would be so I would be so nervous. And that's how I used to feel at work. And I didn't understand that. I was like, but what are they going to do? Beat me? Like, I didn't understand the kind of fear that people had around that. And I think that we needed to be broken away, like taken away from our desks. I think, honestly, I think this time away, yes, it has been very challenging for so many people and for, you know, especially how we work. But I think that it's also injected a real reality that, in all honesty, we have one life, and we are more empowered to be in the driving seat of that. And so it was so like, I don't know if you've seen that viral post on LinkedIn about the guy who had a heart attack, and he was like thinking, the first thing he thought about was his boss, and then the third thing was his wife. That was just, and somebody on Twitter was like, I hope your wife hasn't read this, because the fact that you thought about her third is so crazy.
No, but I think what he's saying though, isn't he? He's reflecting on that eternity. That guy was in the New York Times.
Oh my gosh, I saw that.
Yeah, like, you know, properly. It's so interesting, these things that break through, that transcend. But that comment, that guy on LinkedIn, who, you know, so anyone who hasn't seen it, there's a guy who posted a photograph of him in hospital, had a heart attack. He'd been on these back-to-back Zoom calls since the 12th of Never, like the rest of us, and he had a heart attack. And the first thing he thought as he was having his heart attack was, oh, no, this will make me late for something with my boss. And, you know, witness the fact, you know, he's in a cult or he's in this parent-child relationship. But in when I saw that on LinkedIn, the first comment was from someone, it was, I think this would be better on Facebook, my friend. It's like, oh no!
Oh my god, that's so funny!
I know.
Oh god, no. It's because sometimes on LinkedIn there are things I think this would be better on Facebook and Instagram. Why is this on LinkedIn? But that,
I posted post specifically actually on the last election day. I posted something political on there. Just telling people who I thought they should vote for. Partly because I thought it would go down very badly. And and it produced like a day of arguing. People start telling me that this needed to be on Facebook. I'm not on Facebook. I'm going to post it here. Don't you tell me what to do. okay, you know, I think it's really interesting because I think that LinkedIn guy gives us a sort of hint of, you know, this whole societal desire for a bit of change that you've really sort of, you've captured the moment with this book. What would be the reason why you know, if the previous books you've written are these really powerful, proud identity moments, what would you say is the reason why someone would pick up The Reset?
Ooh, what's the sell? in all honesty, honestly, I think I like to read books that make me think differently about the way the choices I make, because choices are hard work. And I think that it's so easy to go through life and feel like you don't have power and you aren't in control of the way you spend your days. And we spend a lot of time at work, and I always find it just, you know, it boggles my mind that we don't interrogate it enough. We don't interrogate the why we do certain things. And I think that this book should just empower you to think differently about why you work, how you work, and how you live, and how these two things are interlinked, and hopefully make choices based on your true self, not what, you know, has been ascribed to you from the first day you started work, you know, back in whenever. Like for me, it was 2013 when I graduated. And secondly, I will also say that I've got a 15-year-old sister and she's doing her GCSEs. And I remember last year she said to me, I was like, how are you? It's like, how are things going? And she responded over text and she was like, I just feel so stressed out. I feel burnt out. And she used that term burn out at 15 years old. And I was just like, wow. Like, it just was crazy to me. And I was optimistic the fact that she could, you know, articulate herself very well and ascribe a say and say that, you know, she felt burnt out, because I thought you're very smart. But I also thought to myself, it's quite frightening that you feel like this already. And you're going to enter a world of work that's going to make you feel incredibly tense and burnt out, and that just frightens me. And so I think, yes, you know, I'm 28, she's 15, and the fact that I can't remember feeling burnt out at 15. Don't know what that, couldn't even tell you what that meant. And that should tell you how this, you know, the next generation are just going to be super, just very different. And I think they're just, so I would say I want to kind of, you know, talk about these things in this way right now, so when my younger sister gets into the world of work, you know, she doesn't feel, you know, incredibly stressed and felt like the way I did, and makes busyness part of her identity. And if someone says to her, how are you? And she says, oh, I'm so busy, I'm so burnt out, I don't want that for her. So yeah, that's why you should hopefully read my book.
I'm foolishly optimistic though. I don't know if you use much TikTok. I use a disgracefully large amount.
Me too.
But the one thing that inspires me about TikTok is that Gen Z, and I know that these brackets are too general and they are often meaningless, but hot damn, there's so much really brilliant politics on there. And why I love it is because the way they express politics doesn't have the weariness. You know, the whole of my life, I've witnessed politics as this weird thing that people at college or people at school who just weren't normal, but they sort of saw it as a career for them to go and become a professional politician. And then you see these kids on TikTok, these people on TikTok, these sort of, you know, people your sister's age and older, a little bit older, but expressing things in such a brilliant and fresh and original way. And it really inspires me. I just think, wow, okay. Actually, you know, personally, I think unless these are serious redistribution of income, you know, there will be something revolutionary, or there will be something countercultural that takes place, because I don't think it can persist. And when I see, you know, younger people expressing things in that way, it makes me so hopeful.
I'm always asked about this, like what gives me hope, and I say the exact same thing. It is that younger generation. There is that real sense of voice that I know that it took me a while to kind of feel empowered to use my voice. And there's a real fearlessness as well. Like I'm so excited by it, because it does take a lot to kind of, you know, go on TikTok and say what you've, and be so honest about how you feel. And I'm excited by that, because I do think the older you get, the more you feel you have to lose, and you don't know, 22-year-old Elizabeth, the reason why she came up with the idea of Slaying Elaine all those years ago is because it was like, if not her, then who? Like, if I thought it was a real naivety that you have when you are that age. And when I'm on TikTok and I'm around my sister and her friends, I'm energized by that. And I think we owe it, as where we are right now, as people who are in the world of work, to be inspired by that, but also know that we have the power to also, you know, play our part. And that's what I want this book to do, to know that there is power in the choices that we make. And it's not just about you. It's about one voice leads to two voices, and we're all doing it for ourselves, to put each other, because it isn't, we can't leave it up to the government or leave it up to, you know, activists, or it's we are all in this together. And it does sound a bit like, oh, optimistic and Disney, but it isn't, because we've seen things such as Marcus Rashford over the last year. We've seen Black Lives Matter. We've seen so many things that mean that there is power in voices being bound together, and we cannot allow where we spend the majority of our time, i.e. work, to feel like it's the one place that we cannot speak up and we cannot advocate for ourselves and other people.
Yeah, there's something, I mean, you know, I don't need to tell you, because you didn't wait for anyone to give you permission, and you know, at the age of 22, you set about doing these things. So you're the inspiration that, alongside those TikTokers, that, you know, I can draw hope from. But, you know, it's really interesting that we've got an education system that tries to tell people not to wait for permission to do things. Then we send them into a world of work where they're told, you know, wait your turn, obey these rules. It doesn't matter whether you think this doesn't make sense. Just keep your head down. If you want to be promoted, you need to conform. And it's like, you know, we often go out of our way to criticize the education system. And, you know, this, that wonderful Ken Robinson TED talk, which is all about sort of how education drives out the divergent thinking in our heads and forces us to conform.
Yes.
But work is way worse than education. You know, what education, ooh, if you speak to good educationalists, they're trying their best. And worstly, they sort of self-flagellate. They sort of, you know, they say, we know we've got to be more forward-looking. A lot of work doesn't even believe it's got a problem. So, you know.
Oh my gosh, Bruce, you summed it up. They don't believe it, they've got a problem, 100%. And until things go really wrong, i.e. that guy who, you know, who went viral on LinkedIn because he had a heart attack, until things go really wrong, that's when we're like, oh no, there was a problem all along. So absolutely.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
It's a little bit like Sheryl Sandberg's book, though, you know, and I sort of read Lean In. But the thing that I think, and I read her other book, Plan B as well, about resilience. And the thing that, you know, was really alarming for me was that a fundamental lack of empathy that was through her. So until she became pregnant, she couldn't imagine why pregnant women needed parking spaces in big car parks. Or until she was bereaved, she couldn't quite understand why. I mean, it was like remarkably candid, her lack of empathy. And, you know, that's what I worry about, is that, you know, we often see people who these things have come and afflicted them, and all of a sudden they realize, oh, well, I need to think about this in a fundamentally different way. I put some data out last week. Someone contacted me in Australia. And she said, I've been looking into, Australia's sort of largely gone back to the office because they didn't really have coronavirus like us. And and she said, I've gathered this data. We publish gender balance at every level of every company in Australia, really transparent. And she said, and I've also correlated it with the policies of different companies. Anyway, with her, we turned it into charts. She wanted to remain anonymous. But the thing you find from it is that organizations that are really male dominated are asking people to come back to the office. So to your point, the thing we said before, a lot of work doesn't believe it's got a problem. A lot of work believes, you know, I think we've mastered how to do work. Thank you very much. Normal service will now be resumed. And it's just, it's remarkable actually that, you know, the sort of the patriarchy, the system that, to some extent, to a large extent, has failed us before, has got this sort of persistence that it will attempt to come back in some form.
Absolutely. And what you were saying about empathy, I talk about empathy so much generally in life. And I think that's something that hopefully the pandemic has addressed a little bit. And the fact that we've all had to kind of, I was saying to somebody the other day, though, you know, Zoom has not been ideal, it's given us this whole weird, like, through the keyhole of people's lives, and, you know, being able to see the fact that, oh, you're into art, like your bookshelf, there's a real element of like sometimes when we go into work, we're kind of divorced of our individuality. And when we've been at home, we've been able to kind of look at people's screens and look that they actually are people. They actually have lives, they have families. Like, you know, and sometimes I used to receive emails from very senior people back in the day, and they wouldn't even address me in an email saying, hi, Elizabeth, or whatever. It would be like, I'm too important to, you know, address who you are. You're just a computer to me. You're just somebody who, you know, who I need something to, I need you to do something for me. It's a very transactional approach. And their email would always just start with just the request. Like, and it was just that, and I just feel like there was a lack of empathy, and there's a lack of, like, you know, that we went through work in. And I think there's something really nice about the fact that we had to kind of confront that we are all people, we're all trying to do our best, like, and that we need to give each other the benefit of the doubt, and we need to, like, be, I don't want to be, be kinder to each other as if it's, you know, some social media post, but I think there is something that we were kind of going towards before the pandemic that was, you know, very, very vicious and making people really unhappy. And I'm not saying the pandemic has fixed anything by any means, but I think it's, you know, opened up so much of what was so wrong, and hopefully a real optimism now about what could be right about how we move on from this point. And I have this, you know, I say this all the time, in life you have to be pushed or you never be ready. Like, that's just, and I think that, I hope that the book I've written now is that push that people need. And it doesn't mean that's going to solve everything. It's just little things that, but they make a big difference to yourself and to other people. So yeah, empathy is a big one.
Well, I've loved talking to you. Three books published. Same. By the time you're 28, man. Don't underestimate your own power.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
And it's a beautiful looking book, which you've told me that you sort of helped carefully curate and worked alongside a talented team. So beautiful book. And as people are venturing out and going to bookshops at long last, hopefully your ambition to see it gloriously laid out in Waterstones will be fulfilled.
Amazing. Yeah, I hope so. Thank you so much. It's been really, really good chatting to you, Bruce.
Thank you, Liz. Thank you to Elizabeth, Liz, for that discussion. I'm really grateful for I just really enjoyed that chat. It's just great to chat to someone who's firstly sort of thought so much about her ideas and put them down into paper three times. It's quite an accomplishment. Thanks for listening. Always welcome people hitting me up on social media or LinkedIn. You can always get in touch. And I'm grateful for you spending some time with me. See you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.